and we were focusing on ideas of how to introduce an order on the inheritance tree that is there for a certain class in order to create a base for deciding what method to dispatch to. So that's this solution two. The compiler introduces a linear order on the nodes of the inheritance graph. And that's in general called linearization. So that's what we are talking about here. In the literature, you might also find a synonym for that, which is this method resolution order, or for short, MRO. And the question is now, what can we use as source for reasons why to put one class in front of another? And what we take as our basic resources are just the definitions of how classes extend each other, and that is usually done in a kind of incremental way in classes, where you write down something like C extends B or something, or even several of them. You put it down like there, and to make it more compact and to just save space, I just refer to something like this, an expression like that, where we have C as the child class inheriting from A and B. And the two sources to take for an order between the classes is, for once, of course, the parent-child relation, which is the classical inheritance relation over here. That is kind of the rule which we never want to break inside our linearization. And it works in a way that if I define my class C in a way that it extends A, then we get an inheritance relation out of that. And in case that we have multiple inheritance, we might also come up with several others of these. For example, here the one between C and B would then yield also a relation between C and B. And that is the type of relation that we will signify with that kind of arrow in our diagrams. Then there's the so-called multiplicity, which is the second source for some way of ordering those. And this is due to the fact that we specify these extensions or inheritance relations already as a list when we write down something like C extends A and B or something. We already have a kind of priority between this A and B by just writing down inherits from A and B. And that might be another source for hierarchies. So if we find a declaration like this one, we might also introduce a little bit weaker form of relation between A and B like that. And we will find that in our diagrams later on with that kind of edge between them. Okay. What all of these linearizations that we will find later on have in common is that they are to be expected, you can expect them to be a uniform mechanism in the sense that all these hierarchies are valid for no matter what type of lookup you do in your class, whether you look for method M or method L or method O or whatever. For all of them, the same kind of hierarchy applies. So it's a uniform mechanism. And another thing that we will see pretty early on is that linearization is something where in many cases we just can't find a unique way of generating a convenient linearization. It's a best effort approach at best, and we will see also situations where we might break a few of the of the relations that are introduced in the declarations of these inheritances. So, yeah, best effort is, I think, the name for that. So we quickly go through a few of the inheritance relations that we get from a few of the more older approaches. So there is the method resolution order via depth first search. So depth first search is one of the typical ways to obtain such a topological order or method resolution order or whatever you might want to obtain. The question is, now there are several ways of performing depth first search and how to interpret the results. And that's what we're going to focus on here. So kind of a naive way of trying to approach that is just perform standard, leftmost pre-order depth first search is a longish word. Well, the depth first search, I think, should be pretty clear. We choose children before siblings. So that's the depth first. Leftmost means that if we have the choice between several siblings, we take the leftmost out of those. And pre-order means that we enumerate all the nodes that we pass while still being in the process of descending and not when we come back up. That is the pre-order thing. Post-order would be coming back from a subtree, and only when I've finished my the complete subtree, I will yield the node name that I'm passing right now. So leftmost pre-order depth first search. What would that be for our example here? It's a pretty short one, just four letters. Shouldn't be too difficult to come up with an appropriate one. Well, the first one should be immediately clear. If we ever do a pre-order thing, I will start at the root. So we'll start with an A. Then I'm going to descend. I have the choice between two siblings, and it's leftmost. So I should, next of all, I should use this one. Then I've got kind of no choice, so I will go there. And then there's no sibling left. There's no child left. I have to go back up, and the only thing that remains is this one. So that is what I get from that. Now, is that something that satisfies you as a linearization? You're just not the object-oriented programmers, are you? You just don't care about these kind of things. Well, you have a kind of a specification like this one here, where you say C inherits from W, and you find something like that in your linearization. Well, that's not going to do it, will it? So that's a direct violation of the first of the principles that we've seen so far. However, still good enough for Python, at least in an older version. So the just plain leftmost pre-order depth first search is kind of the basic thing that you find in there. Of course, that was something that was very badly received by people who actually care about object-oriented programming. So it was refined shortly after. So the result of that was this guy over here. It's the leftmost pre-order depth first search with duplicate cancellation. I just couldn't bother to put the DC in the end of the abbreviation. So yeah. But yeah, what does that mean? Well, in fact, what you do there is you do the bog standard leftmost pre-order depth first search as you have done before, but you will not stop if your children have already been visited through an earlier branch of your that first search, instead, what you will do is you will descend there no matter what, and just write down the complete sequence, and then afterwards go through the string and cancel all the duplicates that you have found from the beginning. So what you will essentially do is you will have kind of the same run as you have had before. So we start, we start with a pretty similar thing, A, B, W, C, and we just don't stop at C and have another W in there. And duplicate cancellation means that we have to go through the whole thing afterwards and go from the back and find duplicates, and this W is a duplicate of this one, so we will cross it out and get this one here. And that's now good enough for Python since 2.2. Yeah, however, there's still a little bit of results that might be a little bit surprising. Although at least getting all the inheritance relations from principle one right, and that's the example that you find over here. You should notice there that we have class B specified with the parents V, W, and class C with W and V. And you can imagine that with something like that and mixing B and C here in another multiple inheritance relation, well, we'll have to drop one of our principles there. And as usually the second one from the multiplicity is the one that you consider not to be as important as the direct inheritance relation, you will probably have to do without this second type of source of inheritance relations. Well, it will end up with something like that, where you have, well, multiplicity is not fulfillable anyway, so it's a best effort approach in that sense, and that's what is to be expected. And what might be just completely surprising, especially if you consider your methods that you specified for something like C as a module that you have never have to touch again and that you never have to look into again, as soon as you use methods from class C in the context of C being a parent of object A, you will have to deal with the method with object B, I mean. As soon as you have to deal with methods of that class in the context of this A class, then suddenly the priority between both parents just completely are the opposite way, because you would have expected them to be in that hierarchy, or in that priority, and you will find that in the complete method resolution order, they are just switching places. And that is although B actually has some kind of priority over C, so to say. And still, it's B's parents who switch their places. And yeah, well, you could say best effort, but it's still, well, good enough for Python. So, reverse post-order rightmost DFS is the next try in that sense. And yeah, that is now another approach that just throws away this this pre-order concept and just tries whether it can do things better than or at least other than before. And what you do there is you go rightmost first if you have the chance to choose between several children, and just yield your past nodes while returning from a subtree or a subgraph, so to say. So, what would it be here? Well, let's just try it out. This time it's a little bit more complex. It's not a post-order run, so, well, let's just do it like this. So we have A here, that's the start, but we just don't yield anything yet. Then we do rightmost, so we will descend into here, still not yielding anything, no subgraph finished. C, rightmost once again, and W, and from there there's no no further descent. So after a little bit of remaining here, we will return back up, and just now, as we have post-order traversal, we will yield this W. Sorry, that doesn't leave me enough place to write down anything. So W it is, then we're returning from there, so we will have a look at H. H doesn't have any other children, so like that. We will go back up to C. C now has other children. It has an E, well, that's fine. It has a G, and from there we only have seen things already, so it's G once again, because we are going back up there, so we will move away from that. We now look at E. E doesn't have any more children, so we will go back up and put it on the output. C is now done, so we can put C on there, and so on with that. Now A is not yet done. We have to go B. For that we have to go D. G is already seen, so we have D. Then we have to go visit F. We have to put out B, and then finally A. So that is the run post-order rightmost. And in order to make linearization out of that, we just turn it around, coming to that. So that is now the reverse of the string that we have created so far, and that's why I also originally started with putting the W in the end. But yeah. So that's the new extension of the inheritance relation. Although that also doesn't yield very fine results in any ways in all the examples, and that's because so far all the method resolution orders that we have looked at have never taken specific looks at the multiplicity and never have integrated that as a priority in the runs. And that's also why the reverse post-order rightmost depth-first search yields kind of unsatisfying results on specially constructed examples where the multiplicity actually really plays a role. So what's done in that sense is that you can, of course, now that you have realized that what you get from such a realization just based on the inheritance relations, you can just pay attention to which of the multiplicity relations are the ones that are actually failing your result. In this case, it is, I think, the one between F and G that is just the other way around than we would have expected them to be, and to just patch the edge in there and rerun the complete thing. And that's what the refined, it grows longer and longer thing is all about. It just reiterates introducing new inheritance edges between nodes of the graph that have failed the multiplicity relation before. So, with that, Yeah, that should go away if I recompile my sources, but yeah. You'll find that in the online version. So in principle, that's what you do. You add new edges as soon as you find out that there's still a few of them missing, and refine with that edge and rerun your thing so long until you either reach a satisfying linearization or hit a complete disaster in the form of having two edges that are just contradicting themselves. So with that, you then just bail out and say, I can't find a satisfying method resolution order. And that's what you find being used in things like the common Lisp object system implemented. Well, that's not much of a achievement, I would say, because you can customize that system quite a lot. So, of course, you will find one of these things implemented there, but that was an idea of doing away with that. So, leaving the kind of more ancient tries on creating automatic method resolution orders in these more simple approaches, we've already found that that having a situation where you rely on your linearization to be a certain way, and then adding a completely other areas of your code, another specification where you relate kind of more top level things than you are actually working at, and then having that change your local presumption of how linearization actually works is a very ugly design decision. So turned out that it's actually so ugly that that is a kind of an important principle in designing your linearization systems. And that leads to this extended principle, the monotonicity, that says that if a certain priority is induced in some kind of basic block of your object structure, if that thing is induced by the inheritance of this C thing, then the same linearization decision should also be valid for every other linearization of C's children. So once you assume that linearization is established in a certain way, you can always rely on that. That is what you what that should give you. And for something like the refined reverse post order depth first search, that's a principle that's actually not guaranteed. That's the example that should show that to you. If you look at the linearizations for A alone, for A and the linearization of C, and just consider the linearization of C alone, then you would expect G to be prioritized compared to F. Because, well, if you just look at this fraction of this mess of a object heap, then you don't get this part. Thus, you also don't get the multiplicity relation over here, and you can just say that G is somehow part of the left subtree and F be part of the right subtree, thus creating this kind of relation between them. Something like that. But as you have seen me already canceling out a few of the other things, as soon as you start to look at that in the complete context with the A, you get another component B involved in that thing, which then imposes new... Where is it? Yeah. New ways of thinking about F and G. particularly, it would kind of try to revert the relation between F and G into this thing over here. And that's a behavior that you would actually not want to have in a system that guarantees monotonicity, because adding this new child A to an already working system would mess around with linearization, not for plain C objects, but for methods that are written with just the C object in mind, thus relying on a certain linearization priority. Okay, so what can you do? And there have been clever people thinking about that, and the kind of way to go for that is the so-called C3 linearization. Don't ask me why it's called C3. I couldn't just find it. So, but the thing is that that is quite common nowadays, because it's a newer thing, and it guarantees this thing called monotonicity. And it works in a kind of a modular way, in the sense that you kind of have building blocks of linearizations that are then put together, and as soon as you realize that this won't work, you will reject the children, so to say, that are causing these non-monotonous linearizations. So, in order to do that, you kind of need a modular approach to the whole thing, in the sense that what you do is you introduce linearization constraints in order to compute linearizations for all the classes that are present in your system. And these constraints look like the ones that you see over here. So you get a whole collection of these kind of equations, and they are referring to each other, in the sense that you have to put the results that you compute for one linearization into the computation for its children's linearization. So the basic blocks of these things are the linearizations for the leaves, in the sense that, well, for something like the Java thing, you will have the linearization of object is just plain object, but depending on how systems are organized, there might be several of these kind of final leaves in your inheritance. If you have classes that are composed, well, not composed, but that are inheriting from others, you don't have leaves anymore, but intermediate nodes. And for these things, you can compute a more advanced linearization. So, for example, C is considered to be inheriting from B1 to Bn. So it's that kind of relation that we're talking about. And linearization for such a thing is then computed in terms of string concatenation. So that's what you see over here, this little dot, string concatenation. Let's focus on how the actual linearization is then, or list concatenation, something, whatever. Let's focus on how that is composed. So the leftmost part of this linearization is, of course, the class itself, as that is the primary target for looking up methods. And then it continues with something that is constructed out of the linearization of each of its parents. So that is an operator that somehow merges the linearization between B1, B2, whatever, Bn, and also takes into account this multiplicity thing via a string made up from B1 to Bn. And these things are now thrown together and merged in a way that is specified via this merge operator over here. Yeah, the merge operator. How does it look like? Well, you have merge on I components, and you do the merge by looking at each of the lists that you can remember. Linearizations are lists or strings or whatever you might call them, and you look at them and try to find, starting from the leftmost of these lists, try to find the head symbol of one of these lists that is not part of any of the tails of all the other lists. So you select the kind of the class that is only found at the very top of each of the lists and doesn't have any other inheritance relations due to the other linearization lists. Okay? So that's what you see here. You see C is the head of one of these lists, and the condition is that it is not in a tail of any of the others. And you take that and put that in front of the new list and recursively call the merge on the remaining lists, removing each occurrence of the newly chosen C. You might wonder now what happens if you can't find such a C in any of the lists. Well, that is the part where we just bail out and fail. Because, well, that is actually this situation where we have either a contradiction in our inheritance relations, or we might have hit a situation where we can't guarantee monotonicity. So, yeah, that's where the whole thing then fails. But then you can quite clearly locate the computation of a class for which the whole thing failed, and then give feedback to the user while trying to establish a linearization for, in this case, this class C. We have found the following situation. We can't locate we can't construct a linearization. Please change your definitions. Okay, so let's have an example, because that was quite the theoretical slide. So, situation is this mess of an inheritance relation over here. And we try to generate a linearization for each of the components and try to see whether we can find a monotonous linearization for each of them. And yeah, the easy ones are the leaf nodes, where we don't have any outgoing edges. So these two are just taken for granted. So for everything else, we have to start computing something. So ideally, we would want to start with evaluating these formulas for right-hand sides for which we already have intermediate results. So we can now start with computing things that rely only on G and F. And if you take a look at here, we have E, for example, that we can compute now, or D. So these are the ones that we will look at next. So we kind of have dependencies here on what we can compute. So we will have a look at a linearization for E, and what we will have for that is, well, first of all, E will be the start for the thing, the class itself starts its linearization list, and then we will have to merge things like that. For once, we will have to put in the linearization of the, well, what is E dependent on, of F, and that is this thing. So this thing goes over here. And multiplicity also says F. There's nothing else. So we now have to merge the lists F and F with our operator, and it says, well, you have to scan through the parameters of that thing from the left, have a look at each of the heads of the lists. In this case, this list has a head of F and a tail of empty, and look out throughout the rest of the parameters whether F occurs as a tail of the particular list. And this list over here has a tail of empty, and F is not in empty, so for that part we would be done. Then there's nothing else left, so we can take F out of the whole thing. And continue to merge the rest, which is just empty sets, and yeah, that's going to terminate. So we will have E and F as linearization. So that's, of course, that's pretty lengthy that I've done that, but you could, with a little bit of practice, you can shorten that to compute that a little bit faster. So for the D part, we have D. We have to join, well, it's only one class that we're depending on, which by itself only consists of a singular list, so that will probably yield a similar thing than before, and it actually does. So make our life a little bit shorter and just put the G in there. Then, next one, L, the linearization of B. Now, I think we can... the linearization of B is now more interesting. We have now two peers or partners which we have to merge. So what we're going to set up is, first of all, B. We concatenate B with the merge of the linearizations of F and G. L of F and L of G, as well as L and G. That's just the list of my parents, or that, these parents. And L of F and L of G is pretty simple. F and G are just themselves, so we can just do like that. So, merging them, what do we get? We have to run through these lists over there and try out the first head that we find, F. Did I put LG here? That was... obviously nobody cared. F and G, of course, because these are the parents of the thing. You were quite curious letting me run into that trap, weren't you? Anyway... F and G. You have to check whether F occurs in the tail of any of these lists apart from the first one. So does F occur in G? No. Does F occur in tail of FG? No, does not. So we can put F in there. There we have the empty list. Then we have G, and we have to remove F, or every occurrence of F, from these lists. So we have G over here. So now, this thing just doesn't have any head anymore, so that is the only other list that has a head now. So we take this G and compare it with all the other lists. Well, no surprise what will come out of that. That would be a G. So, yeah, like that, B of G. Linearization for C, then. Now we have see, and let's have a look at whether that is really more interesting than before. Well, now the lists are not singular lists anymore, but we have DG over here for E, we have EF, and then for C we have DE, like this one. Good. So first head. So this one doesn't occur in here, so it's okay. Does occur in here, but it is ahead of that, and in the tail it doesn't occur, so that would be a valid choice. So let's make it C and D, and remove D from the lists. Then G is the next head. Doesn't have an occurrence in any of the others, so that should be fine. E is the next head. It's just the head of that one, so we can just put it over here, and then it's only F remaining. So fine so far. And now what we all have expected, because we have used the same example before, that is the one that now creates the problems, because A is now creating a context where we get a little bit of confusion in there. So it's probably quite interesting to see what happens here now. So it starts with A, of course. Then we do the merge. We have to merge B and C. For B, we get BFG. Then we have C. C gets a CDGEF, and we also get B and C. So it gets longer and longer and longer. So we get A. Then we have the candidate B. Is that a fine candidate? This second list doesn't have any B. This one has, but it's in the beginning, so that's fine. Let's remove this and this. Next one, candidate for a head, is F. Well, bugger, we find it in the tail of the second thing, so that is not a valid candidate. How do I continue? Yeah, that's a kind of a premiere thing here. We haven't seen that before. But the idea is to only consider heads. So this list can't have any more heads. It's a list, only has one head. So we have to consider this head. And let's move with this one. So C, a valid valid new component here. So C doesn't occur in here, occurs in here, but is the head here. So that might be a valid contribution here. So let's kill that list and kill the C, and continue with the next iteration. And now we restart with this head F. Still there, so yeah, but we have to do so. That's the way that this operator of merge is specified. So next thing would be D. D is fine, doesn't appear in the other thing. D. F is still in the end of that thing, so now we get G. And now that's the point where we run into deep trouble, because G occurs here. We don't have any other list left. The other heads, the other list's head already occurred in here. And with this, we already have kind of the problematic combination. We have A, the addition of A made a conflict between classes F and G. We can directly read it from here, because it failed with these heads of lists and during the computation of this one. so we can pinpoint the problematic situation there. And yeah, just bail out. So that's kind of state of the art for a lot of linearization algorithms in practical languages out there. So our good friend, but also Perl 6, Dylan, and God knows whatever implementation does a similar thing. Just turns out that if you do try to do these best efforts solution, there's a lot of people who like to just tweak around with the ways of how to construct a best effort solution. But it turns out that a lot of implementations just tend to be reasonable in the sense of they consider monotonicity as an important principle, and as that is already a quite elaborate construction, they say that, well, that's probably what we want to do. Also, if you try to implement that, if you're a little bit used to setting up constraint systems and then trying to solve them, it's quite an easy constraint system in the sense that you don't need to recompute or reevaluate the values of certain of these things, because as soon as you have computed your value for f, for example, it remains the same. So you just have to reevaluate them one after each other. There's a lot more complicated equality system or disequality system solving issues out there in compilers. So that is kind of an easy thing to compute. Anyway, that's kind of the state of the art for linearization. You buy yourself into, of course, a lot of trouble with trying to establish these linearizations in situations where you have your user or a programmer specify the inheritance relations in a non-convenient way and then complaining about you throwing errors as a compiler. But what you get from a successful establishment of a linearization is that you don't need to bother with any switcher duplexer code for certain dispatch situation. They don't have to explicitly name the versions of the functions that you want to call with qualifiers. You always have something like a unique super reference in the sense that you can dispatch to your ancestor just always just use super thing, which is quite of a nice thing. And yeah, the last thing is probably pretty specific to this multi-dispatching technique. For the qualification solution, that is of course a thing that is not a uniform approach as the linearization approach is. So you can decide depending on which method signature you're actually providing what you want to refer to. So it's more flexible in the sense that it's more fine-grained in the sense that how to redirect certain calls. And of course as we have seen, there are quite odd decisions possible in linearization algorithms, depending on the language that you're using. And a few of the choices might be quite unexpected and seem quite awkward to use. So, yeah. If you also, there's, of course, the possibility to just refuse to compile your linearization. So, yeah, you might end up being stuck in situations where you would like to design something but just can't get it to run. Anyway, there is languages out there with automatic linearization, and something like that is also quite the necessary thing if you want to have something like multiple inheritance and also advanced features like the mix-ins thing that we are going to see a little bit, well, probably next year. That sounds so far away, but yeah, it's actually the next lecture, I think. Yeah. Good. So far, so good with the short excursion in the land of linearization. What about our original topic of multiple inheritance and dispatching dynamic method calls? Back to our beloved low-level code and diagrams of memory layout. Yeah, we have seen what we can do for a memory layout of multiple inheritance using classes. We have seen that we have to somehow linearize them in memory, not to be confused with the linearization of the inheritance, but yeah. And it doesn't stop there. The thing is, as soon as you throw also virtual method calls in there, you buy yourself into a whole new class of expectations of the programmer. Of course, everything should just work the way that the programmer intends it to. So in situations like the one that you see here, where you actually have something like multiple inheritance and at the same time have dispatching for virtual methods, like f is here, and you tend to overwrite things. There's also this f over here, and you overwrite that over with the implementation over here. If that is something that should work, then, well, let's have a look at what is actually done in the code over here. There we establish a new instance of C. We cast it to a B, and then use the call to F with a parameter in a legal way. It's just an int that is expected over there, and yeah, that should just work from the perspective of a user of that multiple inheritance system. What does the compiler have to do in order to make that work? Well, that's what you see over here. The memory organization is just as we have expected it to be. So this thing is apart from a little bit of the compiler messing with my types here is as you would expect it to be. So it's just A, B, and C in one sequence, one after each other. But in order to translate the stuff that you've seen over here, first of all, what you need to do is you need to perform casting. And as we have seen before the lecture before, there is a little bit of work to do here in contrast to the non-multiple inheritance case where casting was just a null operation. In our case of multiple inheritance, when we happen to cast into the middle type, like this B thing, we actually need to modify the pointer by the amount that B is offsetted within the C representation. And that's what we see working over here. So what's actually done is we shift the pointer, or not shift it, but we modify it by 16, get this displacement in there, and then yeah, we can safely cast it into a B and then perform the actual assignment here with a store. But that's not so important. The important thing is that we have modified the pointer by the amount that is necessary for that, and that is the size of A. That's in this case just 16 bytes. Okay, so far nothing too special. Apart from, well, maybe if you take a look here, what we're used to see is something like the part that I've framed here that has, well, maybe it's even only this part over here, but there's now a lot of other numbers and figures and all that appearing. So let's maybe focus. Oh, that was not what, that was what I was expecting. So let's maybe focus on what is here now. For in the case of multiple inheritance and virtual method calls, we have not a plain virtual table as you have been used to before, but we now have a composed virtual table. And it is composed into sub-virtual tables. And there's entry points into each of these things. And the entry point into each of these sub-tables is always the first virtual method. So for the first sub-table, the entry point is here. For the second one, it is here. And as they are in the same context, you can expect a pointer to a function that should deal with dispatching to a call to f with an int as the first thing here. So these were kind of meant as slots for a similar method. What you will also find is new slots in there. Let's just ignore that part. That is not covered in that lecture here, but that is about objects being able to identify themselves to for debugging purposes or anything else. How you can read out information about the class, and that's the runtime type information, RTTI, and it's not used for the things that we are doing here. So that is things that is always found one slot above the entry point of the virtual table and usually ignored for our purposes. What's more important is the thing that you find one slot even more in front of that. That is this one and this one. And what that is a numeric value, a constant, that is interpreted as displacement, meaning difference between pointers, and it is to be interpreted not as a matter of pointer difference within somewhere here in the virtual table, but it is to be interpreted on the object representation. So what you find here is for obviously the offset for class B, because I've just written it like that, within the C. And over here it's zero, so there's just no displacement meant for that. And if we go back to here, you see that in our layout, memory layout now, in the object representation, we don't have a single pointer to the virtual table anymore, but we have several of them. Each of them point in somewhere into the common data structure that forms the virtual table for the complete object C, but it points to several parts of that, depending on which access we take into the object representation. So in case that we haven't done any fumbling with casts or anything else, we can assume that pointers to that object will always refer to the beginning of this one here, which will mean that we will always find directly as the first thing that we find under this entry pointer here, pointed to the virtual table, and this will be the one that handles everything that has to do with C, and by casting C to A, also everything that has to do with A. So that is the kind of the general entry into the virtual table. And as we have seen, the object representation that is in front of the other in terms of parents is the one that can safely be casted without modifying anything and can safely take over all the pointers that are also valid for the surrounding C. We can just interpret the content of this table accordingly. But now the thing is, for situations where we have casted into the B representation, or the B part of the representation of the object, we now find that here the virtual table pointer is not pointing anymore into the general entry of the virtual table, but instead into its own kind of private sub virtual table of the whole thing, like here. And why is that? Well, the thing is that in our setup here, we need specific we need to do specific things in order to handle calls to virtual methods. If we enter the situation of calling these methods through an object of type C that has been casted to its B part. Why is that? Well, the thing is that if we have casted at some point, we will have modified the general pointer. This that's what we have done here. We have, in the slide before, we have subtracted or added, I don't remember, but we have somehow modified the pointer to C in order to point to the B part of the whole thing. Now, in the next instruction that we have to do here, we will call a method F. The method F now is actually, or is actually one that is, well, I haven't marked it here, but in principle, there is meant to be an implementation for that method F. That is provided by class C. Now, if I have a call like this, our contract of polymorphism says that if I issue something like this F, what we actually want to be executed at that point, although we are in the sense of compile time type in a B object, as it is virtual and it is complying to the right type signature, we should actually execute F. But as we have also learned last time, we don't recompile specific versions of method bodies just to deal with these inheritance things. We would like to reuse the implementation that we have created for this F within C. The problem now is that in here, in a method body for F, we have scope for all the attributes that are specified throughout A, B, and C, particularly the one the one from C here. So in order to do so, the contract is that the first parameter that we will get given by a call here is a pointer to an actual C object. But as we have learned, pointers to objects are, in our situation, cast away from C and actually contain a pointer to B. Well, that's now a problem, because the underlying implementation of our method F would have expected the pointer to go here. That's why we need to do something, because the code of how to perform this method call will always be the same in every place that we find a B-typed object calling its F. It will always be interpreting its pointer as a B thing, and it will, what it will do is it will first of all try to get the V table from the B pointer, like that thing here. It will try to select the zeroth entry, which will be this one here, and load whatever it finds here. And now everything that is done is it, the resulting thing is then called. And in order to be able to intervene just calling the whole thing with a B pointer, what we can do here is we can instrument the virtual table with a custom function here, which is not a specialized version of the original F, but a kind of a trampoline thing. And that is called a thunk. I think that's the situation here. So if we would have used the same pointer here and here, we would run into this problem of in a situation where we is this the yeah, let's maybe ignore what's over there. The thing is that we have the chance to put in here an address of a special purpose method or function, which you call a trampoline or a func, that will act as someone who relays control later on to the original F, but beforehand tries to adapt the parameters to be convenient for this F, in the sense that this thing is a special purpose function that is made for being found in a situation where we have a B object within C. And in that case, what it will do is it will actually revert the cast that has been done before by just subtracting the same amount of displacement back again from this pointer. Yeah, that seems a little bit ridiculous to first of all displace my this pointer to my subpart of the object and then revert everything back again. But all of that is really necessary to catch all the different arrangements of how you can formulate your calls and how your assignments of types with implicit casting and all that and explicit casting can actually be arranged in a runtime code. And you'll find all the different situations out there. And yeah, to cover that, what you do is you then go into one of these thunks, get this reference here, cast it to something convenient, then perform the displacement here, cast back, and then finally call the original method with a thing that is now correctly transformed into what is actually expected. Yeah, but that's what's happening behind the scenes. So that's what you can be prepared for whenever you use something like the multiple inheritance and virtual methods in the same setting. Yeah, so what you should take away from that is that this is called a thunk, and it reverts the modifications to the this pointer that was due to casting. And yeah, in case you are curious at how these kind of arrangements look like, you can have a look at them yourself by constructing examples with your C++ environment of choice, and then let it be processed with the Clang compiler. And this one can just emit the virtual table layouts. So you can let the compiler print out this diagram for you and even annotate it with the correct roles. So it will even say thunk for method so-and-so in there. So if you're interested in how this whole thing is laid out, or whether you want to create a few exercises for just training for the exam or for your personal pleasure, then yeah, you can dump your virtual tables from there. Good. So that is the thunk, and what you should take away from that is it adds a constant, compile time constant, to the this pointer. You signing up here? Because A is the A's representation is found in front of B within a C. So you, that is the delta B. It's found displaced by the size of A. Let's revert back to the class diagram. So you need size of A for casting up and down.
So we're talking the methods within the class A
What we will end up calling is whatever we find at the zeroth slot of the virtual table. In case that our entry was there, the virtual table is this one. The slot here will be the original F, as A doesn't do any modifications to the pointer. It can share the same virtual table entry as the complete C thing. In case we have another entry from here, we will have come here by modifying the object pointer with delta B beforehand. We will find as the zeroth entry this, you now see I have, please react, yeah. You see me signifying here that this is not the same implementation of F than before. It is a special purpose implementation, which is this thunk, which will, after performing modifications to the first parameter, then call to the same thing as this one. So all the time we will end up with the implementation provided by C, which is C's F, but this one will have a prepending trampoline function that manipulates the first parameter by undoing the displacement that we have had before in order to come through this route. And as we can only reach this entry in the virtual table by having performed the displacement with delta B before, we can be sure to that this pointer that is given to this thunk will have gone through the modification of adding this constant 16, so we can undo that within the thunk and then just dispatch to the original function. That needs a little bit of time to sink in. It gets even funkier. Yeah, because there's also the problem of common ancestors now. There are several ways of how common base classes are handled in C++. The one that is used whenever you don't add any more specifiers to your code is the one where C++ actually creates kind of virtual separated versions of your parents. So it considers situations where A and B inherit from a class L as if there would be two separate classes, L and L prime, that would be inherited from, at least if you consider the memory layout. So that's not a real class diagram here, that's just to illustrate the point that there's some kind of separation going on in that sense. And it looks like that if you implement that. And that's not even the funky part, by the way. Yeah, so you have the situation here where that C has parents A and B. A and B both inherit from L. And as there's nothing else specified here, this L is considered to be having two separate memory representations in respect of their object representations. And that means that in terms of memory representation, we will find class A's representation and class B representation both having space reserved for L. And then the representation for A and the representation for B are both just copied into the structure that represents C, which will lead to a memory layout in the way that you see over here. So B has its own private representation of L as well as A. Yeah, beautiful, isn't it? But I think that's just the convenient implementation of that thing. You just do plain inserting of everything. And if you want something more elaborate, you have to specify that. So that has certain consequences, of course. Looking at that thing over here, for example, it's not really clear what that means, is it? If I cast my C object into an L, yeah, that's also the ambiguity here. Instead of being able to do a cast as the way over here, you can do so, but you have to specify kind of which L you actually mean, and for that the only way you can go is specify the path over which you obtained your L representation, and that is in that case the A. If you would have wanted the other L, you would have had to you would have had to choose B here, but yeah, that's just a way of how you specify that over here. And then there's also, of course, the other thing that if you start from a C pointer, now if you start from an L pointer and want to go back to a C pointer by casting, well, that's not going to do it because, well, the L is present two times in your object representation, and from where should the compiler actually know what you mean when you say you want to do an upcast? So what you can do here is actually tell him how to do so, and with that he will get rid of your compiler errors here. So the whole thing that is behind there is that there's two times a representation for L in there, and yeah, that's kind of it. You maybe also noticed, I don't know whether you did, but maybe I should point it out, that all in all you find only two instances of virtual table pointers in there, and there's only two sub virtual tables involved in the whole thing here. There's a lot of optimization in this planning of memory layouts in there, and a lot of the information in there is actually shared. So this part, as well as this part and this part, all of them are sharing the red part of the virtual table, while this L and this B are both sharing that part. You can tell so because there's just whenever you do casts, there will never be some kind of operation involved in casting between that L and B because, well, there's no multiple inheritance involved in there. So we can reuse the object representation for L when you extend it with B. So there's no need for performing anything like that. Same goes for here. There's no address manipulation involved in that, and same, of course, with this one here. So every time there's no address manipulation needed, you can share infrastructure, and that's also, that's how you can probably say that. Yeah, but that's of course not the only way that you can do things. There's also the way with the shared base classes, where we have, which is called the virtual inheritance in C++, and that allows for representing kind of diamond patterns in your object representations, and that's what's reflected also in the memory layout of these things. And yeah, the way that this is instantiated is by adding this virtual keyword over here, and that leads to class W being shared. by all the its children. So we only have one representation of W in our memory. And yeah, since you have this concept of modular methods, in the sense that they are reused within all the ways that you implement that, that is now gonna have a lot of implications on how to actually organize your management of all the virtual tables and implementations on there. And maybe first of all, what's gonna be a little bit problematic is if you find something like this, where you cast your pointer to a C object, which originally points over here, to a W. The question is, where do you find it? It's actually, you could now say, well, of course, you see over here, there's a W, there's a constant offset in here. But maybe you shouldn't be so sure. Have a look at this one here. I know it's a lot, but yeah, the thing is, you can add another layer of confusion by adding another child in here, this D, that inherits from C, that's still the same C that we have had before. And for example, another time B. And with that, what you will do is you will still have only one representation of W. But now, if you consider a C pointer in that setting here would point over here, and in this setting here, which is actually a D object, if that can still be used as a C object. And C over here, so should be pointing still over here because it's the first parent, so it doesn't do any address manipulations. But what you should realize now is the difference between my entry pointer and the address where I find my W is now not constant anymore. And it depends not on any specification that I've done over here. So going back over here, you can still imagine that there's a D somewhere else. And whenever I have a pointer to a C, from where should I actually know how the memory layout looks like? And I need an idea about the memory layout in order to know where to go from this pointer in order to address a W. Well, what remains to say? You already see the solution over here. What you can do is you can give another annotation into the virtual table, which carries another memory displacement to be interpreted on the object representation, and it actually gives you the displacement relative to your actual address where to find your W. And that is bound to be changed depending on whether you find yourself in an object of origin C or D, because each of these things will get a different virtual table. And yeah, this leads to a lot of new entries into the virtual table. Also, the B part needs a new way of how to how to reach the W representation. And also, if you want to cast back up from W, you need a way to actually know where my object started, and that's where this W over here is used. That is the entry point for the slot for carrying the information about where my original object started. So that's that. this casting back from the virtual child is actually something. Well, originally these cast expressions here would always try to perform addition of a constant. That does just doesn't work here anymore because there's something else to do here. And in order to compile something like that, it should actually perform something like a lookup in here where my object actually starts. We need to do something different, and that's what the dynamic cast keyword comes into play. So that can look up in your virtual table and actually read out that thing. So that's what your dynamic cast is all about. Was it the right direction? No, it was not. The next thing is remember when we talked about the thunks and that there's a need for adapting the this pointer to point to the correct memory representation for the object which we were presuming to write our method for. Same goes, of course, here. We also have to provide the correct this pointer here. But now, in contrast to before, we cannot go the same way as we have done before because there's just no constant giving us a difference between the position of my virtual base in my object representation and the object start anymore. Bugger. Especially as depending on where the actual overwriting of the method really occurs, can differentiate between each of the methods. So there's just not one value anymore that can give us this this displacement. So what remains to do is same solution as every time. We just introduce new entries into the virtual table and just do a little bit of different thunk than before. Yeah, I told you it would be more confusing. Here, these things over here. That's now the new entries that go into the virtual table, and they are actually now not one single value because for each of the methods, it isn't said that they are all overwritten in the same child class, but they can be overwritten in different child classes, thus you have need of different displacements. So what's done here is that same way as methods are indexed like that, you index a displacement -0, -1, -2, which is always found with an offset with an offset of 2 slots in the memory to the start of your sub-virtual table. Yeah, I can understand that you put your hands in front of your face at that point, but yeah, you somehow need some kind of way to denote that. And with that, you get a virtual thunk in contrast to your ordinary one. And all it does is instead of adding a constant to the this pointer, it adds a variable value to there. So the this percent one is just the this thing converted with type. So it's actually this pointer, and this value percent six here is computed throughout that part. It comes from a lookup that is performed during that part, and here you see an access with a negative index. And that's going in that area of the virtual table in relation to the entry to the virtual table. So there was the entry in the virtual table over here, which is navigating here, and it goes back 32 bytes, which will be the G entry of the whole thing. So it will have 1, 2, 3, 4 slots back there, each slot being of a size of 8 on my machine, ending up in minus 32, and that will lead to the value that we find here, and that is what is supposed to be subtracted as this is a negative value probably being found there, it's going to be added or used as an index for this pointer, and only the thing that goes out of that, which is the 7, it will just go through a bit cast in order to obtain the correct type and then end up being this pointer that is given to the original implementation of my G as its first parameter. Yeah. Well, that's what you buy yourself into if you use virtual inheritance, virtual method calls, and multiple inheritance all in one thing. To take away for you is there's thunks there. There's ordinary thunks and virtual thunks. Ordinary thunks manipulate this pointer by a constant value before calling the original method. Virtual thunks do also an address computation, but they modify this pointer with variable read from the virtual table. So that's once again for you at home a description of what the contents of the virtual table is. And also a summary of what's actually happening, because now there's a lot of things that you have to keep in mind. There's things that the compiler does by generating, first of all, of course, doing all the type-related stuff that you've seen in the dispatching part, where you establish a signature. Then you have to compute these subtables that are appropriate for your object hierarchy, and maybe also generate thunks or virtual thunks. And at runtime, what you'll get is a lookup in your virtual table, and you might find also virtual thunks in there. These are executed in order to perform these adjustments of the receiver or this pointer, and with that you will end up with the correct setting for your method to actually execute. Yeah, as it's already late, I think I will skip the polemics for that, as that's all quite based on personal experiences. Yeah, side note for the Microsoft stuff, in contrast to the GCC and the Clang and these openly accessible things, that's a little bit differently realized. For the virtual base pointers, you actually get a virtual base pointer field in your object representation, which manages the navigation between the virtual base pointer and the virtual base and its children, and vice versa. And apart from that, they do things a little bit differently. But I think with the knowledge that you've gathered from the insights of LLVM and GCC here, I think you should be able to navigate your way through that. If you're more interested in that, there's a lot of things to read. I've put it on that list. Apart from that, I'm done with multiple inheritance and this year's topics just in time. So I wish you Merry Christmas in the case that we don't see each other again this year.